Hello and welcome to Safeguarding Voice. This podcast is produced by Education Child Protection, and each episode we explore a different area of safeguarding. Our aim is to empower professionals who work with children and vulnerable adults with information and guidance. This episode, we're joined by safeguarding consultant Carly Danes to talk about secondary trauma or vicarious traumatisation. Carly has worked in roles in both further education settings and for the local authority, as well as being a qualified therapeutic counsellor, and has lots of vital information to share with us all. Hi Carly, thank you so much for coming and doing this episode with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, we're going to dive right in. What is secondary trauma or vicarious traumatisation?
Okay, so when we reference the term secondary, what we really mean is that although the primary, the original trauma, has happened to someone else, the fact that you have seen, you've overheard that incident has actually been traumatic for you, that it's leaving a residual, traumatic impact on you in a secondary capacity.
Okay, so that makes sense and resonates with me. I can think of some situations as a professional where that's definitely resonating. But I've not really heard it referred to as secondary trauma or vicarious traumatisation before. Mm-hmm. So why are we starting to hear about that now?
Well, I think in all honesty, the conversation around mental well-being and prioritising mental health, especially within the workplace, is something that we are typically hearing a lot more conversations around now. And, you know, look at what's going on in a global context at the moment when we think about all the anxiety for people in terms of, you know, international conflict, environmental fears and concerns, the cost of living, as well as, of course, the aftershocks we're still feeling from the pandemic. Mental health, I think, is very much on the agenda of a lot of people's awareness. And when we kind of filter that down into an organisational perspective, what we recognise is actually a lot of our, you know, pupils or learners, if we're in education, or indeed our service users, if we're in kind of a wider workforce, we're seeing, you know, the stresses, the anxiety, and staff equally are seeing an increase then in how they're impacted by being around that, being alongside those individuals as part of their, you know, exposure within the workplace. So I think there's this growing awareness of how, of course, we need to provide support in the well-being of our service users, but in addition, how staff are now beginning to be impacted themselves by being alongside those who are in that adversity.
Okay. So I know that there'll be lots of people listening to this podcast where this is sort of making the antenna go up and thinking, yeah, that's definitely something that I've come across before, and we're now starting to see a higher awareness within the workplace. I think you're right when it comes to our teams and their mental health and how we support that. And I'm sure that people can already think of some incidences where they've been in this situation where they've either gone through it themselves or they've supported somebody else.
Yeah.
But in order to advise and support our listeners, what would you say are the symptoms or indicators of secondary trauma or vicarious traumatisation, so we can look out for these amongst our colleagues and amongst our teams and provide that help?
Yeah. So if we're looking to perhaps define maybe some symptoms or signs that we could recognise perhaps in others when they may be experiencing some form of secondary trauma, I think the kind of red flags I'd be looking for are things such as that staff member experiencing almost flashbacks. Perhaps they are talking, you know, long after the incident has happened, that they're, you know, revisiting that, they're reminded of that, that it's something they're taking home with them after the day ends. Or it may be noticing actually their behaviour has changed, that they're avoiding certain scenarios or situations that reminded them of that incident. It could also be thinking about staff members who talk about a change in their beliefs. Maybe, you know, after having been exposed to that incident by somebody else, their feelings have changed. Maybe they are experiencing that compassion fatigue, which we've touched on. Maybe it could be almost a state of hyperarousal. You notice that they're on edge, that they're anxious, that the smallest thing can kind of re-trigger them. So I think those are kind of the symptoms I'd be looking at to define perhaps and recognise in others. I think it's really important to first off make sure that you cultivate a safe space within your workplace, that staff feel
confident in maybe being able to speak up and recognise it themselves, if they fear that they've been impacted, that they can share with their managers through those usual support mechanism systems such as one-to-ones, case supervision, so that they feel able to share if they indeed recognise. But of course, in some ways, this manifests without the awareness of those staff members. It might be others around them that recognise a change in behaviour, a change in presentation. Maybe they're more fretful, they're more anxious, starting to show signs of perhaps burnout or compassion fatigue, where they're just depleted on every level of providing that usual, you know, sustained high level of care. So I think it comes back to almost that relational foundation that we need to be building with our workforces, cultivating that space of safety as and when, you know, those work colleagues may come forward and recognise they're struggling, that they therefore feel able to be supported during that process, or just recognising those changes. You know, staff who perhaps usually engage with service users or learners really well and effectively, but are beginning to show, yeah, that compassion fatigue, that almost tiredness of engaging with others, and that lack of motivation to keep checking in, to keep sustaining that level of care. That would raise almost red flags, certainly for me. And in my work and experience, those tend to be the things which initially picked up on. So it's really about knowing your workforce and recognising those changes and providing safe spaces really to explore what's going on there under the surface. Could it be some element of secondary trauma?
That is so important to raise, I think, because that reliance on us as professionals to always recognise when it's happening to us and to bring it up ourselves, actually the nature of secondary trauma could actually mean that we're not able to recognise that.
Yeah, or not yet in touch with that.
Exactly, because of that burnout feeling that you quite often have when you're suffering from that. So being aware of our colleagues and being able to support our colleagues in different ways is such an important point to raise around this, just in case that person isn't aware at that time because of the symptoms or the indicators that they are suffering around those different things. That's so important to bring up. My mind is just going, because I can think of like a million different situations throughout the years where this has been so relevant, especially when you're working with really complex, vulnerable cases.
I mean, we're only human at the end of the day, but I think we need to be mindful not to solely rely on direct disclosures by staff, that actually sometimes passive disclosures, you know, those moments of frustration, of high anxiety, of statements such as, oh, I've just had enough, I just can't take it, actually could be an indicator that a staff member is really struggling and maybe with some form of secondary traumatisation.
Yeah, that's so important, so important. So when we're talking about secondary trauma, who do you think could be at risk? What could make a member of the team quite vulnerable to going through something like this within their professional role?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the statement is anyone. You know, we all have mental health. Sometimes it's really good, sometimes it really struggles. But actually, as course of our work, any of us could have exposure to working with someone who, just hearing their adversity, is traumatic for us. So it really could be anyone and everyone, but those that perhaps are maybe additionally vulnerable, it's perhaps those that maybe already have stresses, anxieties, things going on in their personal life, which is affecting their professional capacity. And, you know, the risk we have there is if we don't cultivate these safe spaces where staff feel able to be open with how they're doing, then ignoring of that could lead almost to this bottling up effect, and then things becoming too much, which then affects their output, affects their ability to continue offering that high level of care.
That is so important to think about as well when we're with our teams. I remember, it feels like a million years ago now, very much work culturally, you know, you leave your personal life at the door. You leave it at the door, you come into work, and that's what you're doing whilst you're there, and your personal stuff does not have any bearing on what it is that you're doing as a professional. And that was very much the culture. And as that's changed, that's been so important, because it doesn't even have to be anything bad. I can think of times in the past where I remember moving house, and that was just such, I was so exhausted just on a physical and mental level from moving house, that of course that then affected me when I was walking into the workplace. Because if you think of yourself as a battery even, you're actually already depleted when you're walking in because of the stuff that you're doing.
Yeah.
And all of these things, when you are, regardless of your role, if you are supporting children or vulnerable people and something is going on for them, you need that energy. You need to be wired. You 100%. Need to be switched on. And you need to be responding appropriately. And that is so vital that actually... then you've got nothing left in order to do those self-care, to look after your mental health, if you've got nothing left after that because of things that are going on. And I think that's been a really positive change that I've definitely seen throughout my professional career, where things have become a little bit more aware and a more accepting of who we are as individuals and who we are as people and what we actually bring to the table. Because leaving your personal life at the door... I'm not talking about being unprofessional, but the reality is there will be things going on in your personal life that deplete that battery.
Yeah, understandably, you know, we are all human at the end of the day. And you think particularly those staff that work in frontline pastoral type roles or in a pastoral capacity, so much of what they bring to that role isn't just energy, but also caring towards others. And that in itself takes energy to do. And if you're already running on that deficit, that can have a negative impact on your ability to continue to sustain those high levels of care. So I think, you know, particularly for staff that run those frontline provisions, whether it be a DSO in a school, whether it be a health professional, whether it be some sort of service that has that front-facing engagement with vulnerable people, whether that's children or adults, even more so, you are susceptible to seeing trauma, being around trauma. So it's about enabling that inner resilience and self-care, enabling you to do that, I think.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so I am a professional in the workplace, and one of my colleagues who I line manage has bit my head off a few times, that's probably not the right term, but has, you know, said to me, no, I can't do that now, no, I'm really busy, I'm getting a bit of passive comments from them, I know they've got a few bits going on, but when I'm approaching them and I'm saying, I'm trying to create those safe spaces, let's go and have a cup of tea, or I've had a one-to-one, and I'm asking them, you know, anything you want to talk about, is everything okay? I talk about their cases, I know they've got some complex cases at the moment, but they're not bringing to me anything further. What advice would you give to somebody in that position who's trying to support a colleague who can see that they're maybe struggling a little bit at the moment, but really struggling to get to the bottom of either why or how they can be supported?
I mean, it's really hard because it's very much a partnership that actually, yes, you want to create and cultivate safe spaces, but there's two of you in that dialogue, there's two of you in that room. So as much as it is about offering support, it's about the personal accountability for both people within that space. And maybe if you're finding there's barriers or difficulties in even getting to those conversations, dial it right back. Find out what's going on in the dynamic. What is the relational barriers that are inhibiting the ability to have those really honest, transparent conversations? Because that's essential, you know, and that takes courage to actually be vulnerable, to expose perhaps things that we are struggling with, that we're uncomfortable with. But the end output is that safe space to explore, to look at different ways of working, to apply things, you know, within what we're able to offer, of course, but in a way that personalises that support mechanism. So the one-to-ones, the case supervision, you know, being very reflective in those spaces and having ownership from both parties, I think is hugely important, because you're not going to have that honest dialogue without that input, that equal input from both people. But when we think about the responsibility on behalf of the supervisor, it really is about enabling that safe space to allow that relationship to be cultivated, to develop, which comes back sometimes to knowing your staff, or better knowing your staff, figuring out ways to do that. How do they tick? How do they communicate? What are the systems that are relevant for them? What barriers are they facing already before even entering the workplace that maybe you want to visit with them to see if there's any
anything you can accommodate, anything you can be flexible around, just to really encourage that relational foundation, really.
Mm. So just to unpick that a little bit further, I know that you've talked about creating those safe spaces and using case management and one-to-one, all of those processes. But on a wider scale, have you seen anything within organisations that you think culturally has been really positive and really effective that you could share, that you think actually does cultivate on an organisational level that kind of safe space?
Yeah, I mean, I can certainly reflect in my own working career, you know, examples of where I've had really effective supervision, that I've come away very engaged, very enthralled, very willing to, you know, to continue the work I'm doing, and the barriers being overcome, the parameters being really clear. And then equally, some examples of where it hasn't been great. And the long-lasting impacts of those situations, you know, are still in mind. You know, there's still those seeds of doubt to my confidence, to my ability, which are framed largely by those negative experiences as well. So I think, you know, coming back to the question around best practice or best case examples, it really is, you know, when I'm in that dialogue, that dynamic with my manager, when I feel seen, when I feel heard, I feel valued. And then when I feel valued, I'm then able to be more confident with being vulnerable. And there's a real power to vulnerability, you know, because it really elicits that honest working partnership, because supervisors equally aren't psychic. Sometimes we need to tell them what we're struggling with or what works best for us. But it's having those moments of self-reflection, having those internal feedback loops, I think really enabled that in me. So whether or not from a structural level there's the capacity within, whether it's one-to-ones, whether in supervision, but for almost the supervisee to have those moments of reflection in a way that resonates personally with them is really important, because without that self-awareness, how can they apply self-care?
I mean, I also remember just being profoundly impacted by the lockdowns and by the pandemic. At that time, I was working in a role where I was supporting extremely complex, vulnerable young people and young adults. And the loss of the team dynamic, so being able to actually have that space with your team, whilst we found our feet with all of the other tools where we could effectively continue to supervise people and continue to have those, was really profound.
Yeah.
And I definitely suffered probably one of my worst times of secondary trauma during that time, because I had lost all of those support mechanisms within the workplace without being able to do that. And I'm talking about sitting around a table when you're all eating lunch and you're batting things to each other and you're creating those relationships. I'm talking about when, as an organisation, they would put on team days and we'd get to do some recreational time together in order to build that trust as a team and do those things. All of those things actually lead into a very culturally healthy work environment in regards to our mental health.
Yeah, definitely.
And the loss of that really highlighted to me, oh gosh, these things are so important, they're so essential to how we can actually get through and do what is essentially a really difficult job some days. It's really, really hard, and the impact of what we can sometimes take home, and that plays back into the leave your problems at the door. Well, I don't get to do that when I go home either. Quite often you're taking these things home and you're thinking about them. So it does definitely swing both ways, and that complete loss of those support systems, even though it was temporary until organisations found their way and found their feet with it, was still really difficult, really difficult.
Yeah.
So I think, all of the things that you're raising are so essential in how we work together and how we support each other in order to create those environments, for sure. Because when they're not there, it definitely, definitely has an impact.
Yeah. And a lot of it as well is about being curious to find out more. I mean, there's lots and lots of information and guidance now around this notion of being trauma-informed, being aware that our brains are social organs. They grow based on those interactions or experiences we have. And if some of those experiences are negative or adverse, even within a workplace capacity, that can change the wiring sometimes. You know, not always in a long-term or a permanent capacity, because our brains constantly grow and develop, but certainly in the short term, that may be where we start to manifest some of these indicators, some of these signs that something's not working, you know, great for us, which has had an impact on the output for sure. And the government actually produced a recent guidance around trauma-informed practice. I believe it was the 2nd of November. So there is things even at a statutory level now, which is encouraging us as organisations to start thinking about this whole subject area around how we can enable and support staff as and when they could be affected by, you know, either their own trauma, their own experiences, or just that secondary basis of it going on around them. So yeah, educating and that commitment to change, to explore, to work with your colleagues, to better understand your colleagues, to really enable that, you know, from preventing from becoming a barrier for staff, for your service users, effectively, your learners, pupils, whoever they may be. And that impact that we have, you know, from being around service users who are in adversity, is huge, because again, we're human. You know, a lot of what we do, particularly if it's in a pastoral role or capacity, is giving ourselves, you know, giving ourselves our feelings, our empathy, our space, our headspace even, to those service users.
And I can think of a direct example from my own working experience. I was relatively new into my working career. It was during my time as a designated teacher for care experienced learners. And I can recall actually one situation where I was supporting in a pastoral capacity this one care leaver who had quite significant self-harming tendencies. And during kind of a very informal catch-up, sort of a check-in just to see, you know, how they were doing, they disclosed to me the reasons behind their self-harm. They'd been experiencing, you know, some situations around prolific sexual abuse, which was part of the reasons which led to them entering the care system in the first place. And this was the first time that this, you know, learner had felt comfortable and confident in actually sharing what had been experienced by them. And even in their description, you know, it was almost quite matter of fact that what they were saying, but the detail of what they were saying was horrific, you know, some really abhorrent stuff, which I can remember, you know, how they looked, what they were saying, and being completely floored by it. You know, it wasn't something which I was expecting. It wasn't something which I could prepare for. You know, I wasn't really informed about what had happened. Obviously, professionals were aware, which what led to them being within the care system in the first place. But I think in terms of my knowledge of this young person, this was kind of my first exposure to it. And yeah, the words which they described, what happened to them, the phrasing, the that stuck with me for a really long time. And even down to, you know, without going into specifics of the incident itself, you know, there was implements which were used within that process, quite ordinary implements that, you know, are ultimately for other purposes. And I remembered, you know, being at home and seeing an implement that learner had described was used, and yeah, it almost giving me a flashback to that conversation, to that moment in time where they had told me about what had happened to them. So, you know, the experience, the trauma was to them, it wasn't to me, but I was traumatized by it, by hearing actually the account of what happened. And I'm quite a visual person as well, so quite often when people describe things to me, it builds a very clear picture in my mind, in my processing. So as and when she was telling me these things, I could see it. And that was really upsetting for me. And I recall going to my manager at the time and trying to, you know, within our supervision, explain how I was affected, and really struggling with describing that, you know, I almost felt a bit of shame in feeling upset or affected by it, because it wasn't something, you know, in my experience, and it was something that was told to me. And I think, you know, even though I had a really good relationship with my manager, and felt supported by them, they equally didn't know how to help me either. This is going back, you know, nearly a decade now, so there isn't the awareness around this subject as there is at present. And although I think they tried to help me, it wasn't something that really was in their understanding of knowing how to either. So that's an example of where, you know, for me, in my experience, it has been really challenging.
And I think, you know, looking back, that may have in some way led to how my further career evolved. You know, I ended up being within children's services for a number of years. I've trained as a, you know, a therapist. And I feel like in some ways the lack of care that I got has maybe really, you know, invoked in me how important it is to be aware of that residual effect, that secondary effect, because it's real, it's tangible. And really hard. And actually, I think I'm really encouraged now that there is this growing awareness and understanding and commitment by managers and organisations to look at their staff's well-being, because if you are in that frontline capacity, you will be affected. And quite often people end up in those jobs because they are wanting to help, they want to make a difference, they're caring, they're empathic. But equally, if there's no care and diligence to them, that burnout is the next inevitable stage. And there was a period of weeks, months even for me, where I did have that compassion fatigue. My walls went up. I think from almost a defensive angle, I was conscious of feeling too warmly towards our learners since then, because of how significant that trauma was for me, even within that secondary capacity. And, you know, I worked through the emotions of initially perhaps a bit of anger at the organisation, maybe a bit of anger towards my manager, frustration, not feeling of value, of any worth to have any input on me. But in all honesty, back then, I mean, this was a you know, probably a decade ago now, I'm not sure there was that understanding. Mm. I'm not sure it wasn't through lack of care that my manager didn't offer me support. I'm not sure that they knew what support to offer, because it just wasn't a topic that was discussed. There wasn't a lot around staff. You know, you were expected to be capable and resilient, and if not, you were sanctioned.
Yeah.
But never that exploration of perhaps why that, you know, level of effectiveness in your practice has changed, particularly if your work is so emotive by nature of the role that you have.
I definitely agree with that. Just, yeah, thinking back on past experiences and past roles, always been for really lovely and caring organisations.
Mm.
So it wasn't, the lack of care was never because it wasn't there. It was through a lack of understanding, I think.
Yeah.
And I remember back in the day, I mean, the only resource that we had was a clinical supervision that would have to be set up and reached out to. It wasn't culturally part of the workplace where we were looking after ourselves.
Yeah.
So I'd completely agree with your assessment around that, because, yeah, I remember organisations that I worked for were lovely. It really wasn't through...
As was this one.
Yeah.
And I had a really good relationship with my manager, like person to person. I felt supported by them.
Mm.
But I just think in this situation, there was just I don't know. There was a lack of knowing, of knowing how to support me. So that support wasn't ever explored. Mm. So the fact that we are now having these conversations, you know, at a national level as well as localised within our own organisations is hugely important, because of how, you know, our staff are our best and biggest resource.
Yeah.
It's them that we invest in.
Mm.
So if our workforce is suffering from burnout, if they're depleted, if they are unable to keep giving that energy, that compassion, our systems will fail to our service users. So it really is, you know, flipping the narrative, empowering our staff, offering them opportunities of support, whether that's through internal EAP type systems, counselling provisions, just an awareness of locally what there is available for those members of staff.
Yeah.
But also in-house, thinking about how effective are our support mechanisms, our one-to-ones, our case supervision, are our supervisors even providing that opportunity to say, how are you? But really, how are you? Because even just the follow-up is is allowing or inviting an opportunity to share.
Exactly. It is important and it's so, so positive. I know you just touched on it briefly, but is there anything else we can share with our listeners, information in regards to where they can get further information about what we've talked about today?
Yeah, I mean, there are some absolutely wonderful resources out there, not just always aimed at adults or professionals, but also resources that could be easily transferred to young people, to service users, whether that's in our workforce, young people, apprentices, trainees, or even just maybe the young people in which we engage and we work with. The NHS, you know, itself has lots of kind of health perspective focus. NHS Scotland has some wonderful videos. The UK Trauma Council, again, lots of really good information about just how trauma can affect our ability to relate, to communicate on every level, you know, socially, professionally. The Anna Freud Centre has lots of wonderful resources for children, for families, really thinking about that systemic support, which equally can apply to staff. And of course, for our educational colleagues, there's the education support team. They now have a resource purely aimed at this subject around secondary trauma. Ben, a psychotherapist, has produced some wonderful videos in very user-friendly language, just really exploring this content to open up those conversations. So they would kind of be my first go-tos.
Okay, that sounds amazing. We'll make sure that we put links to all of that in the podcast notes for everybody. But thank you so much for coming along today and sharing such expertise and your stories and case studies as well. Really appreciate you sharing those with us. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us for this latest episode of Safeguarding Voice. For any documentation or further guidance referenced in this episode, please see the show notes. Thank you to our guest Carly Danes for joining us. This podcast was produced by Education Child Protection, editing by Leonie Thorpe, music production by Abby Dowsett. For more safeguarding information, we can be found on social media on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. If you liked this episode and haven't already, please do listen to previous episodes in the series. And we hope to see you next time for our next episode of Safeguarding Voice.